Hi, I'm Weird Al Yankovic, and you're listening to the Pantheon Network.
I can talk about my perception of Lizzie's lyrics and not being able to make them out, because I know that for a great deal of her stuff I've seen it written down, and it's like lyrical. Quite simple words sometimes, but I think my perception is that she's been so insecure over the years that she's not wanted to, let people know what she's singing for fear of being judged, for fear of being, you know, laughed at or whatever. So she's taken simple words and twisted them around and made them sound the way she does.
And welcome to No Filler, the music podcast dedicated to sharing the often overlooked hidden gems that fill the space between the singles on our favorite records. My name is Quentin. With me, as always, is my brother Travis. And today we are talking about, and today we are diving into Cocteau Twins' second studio album, Head Over Heels, from 1983.
So, Q, we did an episode on their 1990 record, Heaven or Las Vegas, back in 2022, the year that we did nothing but 90s stuff. Jumped into a bunch of alt-rock and shoegaze bands from the 90s.
Yeah, and we joke, but honestly, dude, I think we could just do an entire podcast on just that music.
Right, I agree. But yeah, my exposure to Cocteau Twins is mostly their 90s stuff. So I also just recently got into their 1994 record, Milk and Kisses, which just had its like 30-year anniversary, like remaster vinyl that just came out. So yeah, I'm familiar with 1990s Cocteau Twins.
What kind of blows my mind is how early this was in the 80s. I don't know. Like, I didn't.
83, yeah.
83. And this is just one of those examples where I'm always learning about music.
Never stop learning.
And it's history. Yeah. And like, yeah, this album kind of blew me away, dude. And it's heavy. Yeah, a lot of times it is heavy. And what's cool is I didn't really think too much about this being a genre, but of course it is. This album is ethereal wave.
Well, I mean, that's Elizabeth Fraser in a nutshell, dude.
Right.
Like ethereal, right?
Ethereal, and that's why I thought that clip that I brought for the intro was interesting. That was Robin Guthrie.
So he's basically saying that the reason that she like her lyrics are hard to decipher sometimes is because she's purposely
shrouding them
because she's self-conscious about her lyrics.
I mean, that's kind of how he put it.
Interesting.
Which is interesting.
I mean, it's funny because that's like part of, you know, the appeal of Cocteau Twins is that they're, you know, it's like they're like an alien. She's like an alien from another planet, you know, like the way
right.
She talks, sings stuff.
Yeah, ethereal.
Or maybe ethereal is better, you know, like an angel. I said alien. Let's go with angel.
There we go. Right. And this album is kind of considered the archetype of ethereal wave music. So I, of course, you know, rabbit hole time, I kind of dove into like what ethereal wave is. So the defining characteristic of the style is the use of effects-laden guitar soundscapes. Robin Guthrie?
Yeah.
That is his style, like, to a T. Even to this day, like as his solo works, that's what he you know, sound laden or effects laden soundscapes.
Yeah, well, what's interesting about, I mean, that's what's interesting about that is that My Bloody Valentine hadn't even really defined their sound yet.
Right, dude. That's what I'm saying. Like,
so like this is like a stepping stone to like what we think about as shoegaze, right?
Right, and that's okay. Here's the main thing that I've learned in listening to this album. So I think, same with you, beforehand I was listening to more their you know, their stuff from the 90s, mm-hmm. which has definitely, I guess, mellowed out would be like, I feel like it's more in line with the dream pop aspect. And here we go again, right? But like their 90s sound, I think you think more of like the dream pop soundscape. But yeah, this early stuff is way more heavy and like distorted. And yeah, so we need to, like, I need to start thinking more about how like important Cocteau Twins was.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
for shoegaze.
Yeah, because when you think about shoegaze, it's really the late 80s when the term starts to pop up and stuff like this. So like,
and this is 1983.
Yeah,
And we haven't even really gotten into it, man, because we haven't even listened to the tunes. Get ready, man. It's such a cool album.
One of my favorite things to do here is like go back far enough to hear like how did we get to shoegaze kind of thing. And
right.
So that's and you know, this band is always considered like, you know, one of the staples.
In the top five.
Yeah. And you know, like we said, they kind of sway, you know, lean more towards dream pop. But I mean, the guitar effect laden soundscapes, I mean, that is crucial for shoegaze, you know what I mean? All those guitar pedals and stuff.
Yeah. So it goes on to say, primarily based on minor key tonality, frequently post-punk oriented bass lines, restrained tempo and high register female vocals, often closely intertwined with romantic aesthetics and pre-Raphaelite imagery. Now, that was another rabbit hole that I went down, and we'll get into that later, because what the heck is pre-Raphaelite?
That's just some word ChatGPT made up.
No, I didn't know. I didn't get that from ChatGPT. Okay. It's mentioned in the Ethereal Wave wiki page. All right, dude. So let's just dive right into the first track that I'm going to pick. Let's just dive into the sound, bro. All right. So we're going to play track 2 off the record. This song is called 5-10-50-fold.
Yeah, it's just really interesting, you know, like it's just different, you know, well, over 40 years later, it's still like interesting and different, you know what I mean?
Yeah, something about the way that her vocals are captured, like,
yeah,
it feels very like cavernous, Which is funny because when I look at this album cover, I see like a cave.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's what that is. But yeah, I just feel like I'm in like a expansive cave deep underground, you know, and I'm like turning the corner and I'm hearing this stuff.
Well, so Ned Raggett or Raggett of the Guardian. Ned
Ryerson?
That just happened recently, Q. Groundhog Day.
Oh, yeah. Groundhog
Day. He wrote that Frazier's singing was more direct in the mix than it had been on the band's first album.
You know, I haven't really given their first album a listen.
Me neither.
A proper one. Which is Garland, which came out in, I believe, 82, I think.
And Q, although her lyrics were still often understandable, she began to shift away from conventional vocabulary towards enigmatic, emotional sound, which maybe is what Robin was saying.
Yeah, her voice became just as much an instrument.
Yeah. So, like, musicians. Speaking of her voice, that's, you know, it's her not to just, like, completely ignore the bass player, but it's, you know, well, actually, what's funny about this particular record is that Robin was the bass player as well. So apparently,
yeah, he did on all this the record. He did. He wrote all the music. Yeah,
that is something.
Yeah, it was just them two back then, Trev.
Okay, wow. Yeah. So I was just there you go. I was about to say, her voice plus all of that reverb and all the effects and stuff like that that he put on the guitar, mm-hmm. and I guess the bass and everything. Like that's what makes Cocteau Twins. You know. That's what makes them the band that they are.
That's
you know what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. No, but I thought this was interesting. Guthrie says, we'd had no previous inclination to make music prior to the Cocteau Twins being formed. So it was a new thing for us. I don't think we were directly influenced by anybody. So... when they met, they hadn't even really thought about making music, and then it just kind of happened. Like, neither of them had any inclination to make music prior to that band forming. So this was their first thing for both of them. They were really young when they started. I think he had mentioned he was 19 and she was 17 when they first started making music together. That's young, man.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting because, you know, in terms of him claiming that they weren't influenced by anybody, you know, her vocals have like hallmarks of like 80s vocalist, right?
Right. And Susie and the Banshees have been around since like the late 70s. So, yeah, I could definitely see that.
But, well, yeah, let me just get the name of the lead singer. I've always just thought Susie too.
It is, like, dude. You know. Susan Janet Ballion.
Well, there we go. Susan.
Known professionally as Susie Sue.
Susie Sue, yeah. So, I mean, that's this, you know. And, they had been around for a few years at this point. I wonder if they ever toured together. That feels like that would have been...
I'm sure they did.
That would have been a good matchup there.
Well, so since... My guess is you've probably listened to more of their later albums than I have. How does this sound compared to their later works?
I feel like there was a lot going on that track, and
yeah,
she's screaming too in a way. Not really, you know, for the most part, she's kind of yelling, right? And like their later stuff, like in Heaven or Las Vegas, and then definitely Milk and Kisses, like it's a little bit more pop, if you could just use the word pop, right? I mean, like more straightforward pop type stuff, dream pop, I should say.
There we go.
Yeah, they were just getting a little bit more melodic and more structured. Maybe that's what I'm trying to say. Is like this record feels, I don't know, it just felt kind of noisy.
Yeah. Get ready for more of that, Trev.
Okay.
So, all right, we're gonna jump down to track 4. And so this is In Our Angelhood, which has been described as both post-punk and proto-shoegaze in its sound. Proto-shoegaze, Jeff. Here we go.
All right.
Again, this is In Our Angelhood. ¶¶
Yeah, you definitely hear it.
Post-punk for sure.
Yeah, and it's very, you could tell it came out in the 80s, Q. That's what I was trying to say. Like, okay. It's got, you know, but not, that's not an insult. I'm just saying, like,
right.
Yeah, like, you know, this is definitely a song that has all the hallmarks of the 80s. Like, there's some new wave stuff in there. Like, yeah, post-punk right. stuff. Man, I didn't realize that Robin did every instrument on this record. It's really cool. I wonder when the bass player joined.
He joined not that long after.
Okay.
I think for Sunburst and Snowblind, which was a little EP that came out in the same year, I believe he was on that one.
So this is just like, you know, this is just two people that wanted to make some music together. And so Robin's like, I guess I'll play the bass and I'll figure out a drum machine and stuff so we can get some proper tunes yeah. here.
Right. And which is cool because 80s is about the time when you were able to do that.
Yeah.
You know, because you had electronic drum, you know,
and that
sampling and all that stuff.
That's, I think that's kind of what I'm, what I mean when I say, like, you could tell it was made in the 80s because, like, that, the drum machine, right?
Right.
Has a sound, like, has a distinct, you know, characteristics to it and stuff like that.
Yeah, so there's only however many different drum sounds that are on a drum machine.
Stuff. Yeah, exactly. But that contributes to the sound, you know. But yeah, that was, compared to the first song that we played, like, much more of a straightforward melody and pop song.
Yeah.
Right. And then, yeah, all that reverb, man. Like, that's kind of what Robin is known for. It's like, he has this sound that he gets out of his guitar that is heavenly, Q.
Dude, and he was, I mean, early, he was probably in his early 20s when this came out.
Well, what have I done with my life?
That's what I'm saying, dude. I know.
Well, here's another quote from that Reggette fella who wrote for The Guardian. He said, Fraser's voice became just as much an instrument as those played by her musicians, including Guthrie's multi-layered and heavily reverberated guitars. He also remarked, In Our Angelhood probably fits the bill best, and it's a track that would have sounded out of place on Susie and the Banshees' Kaleidoscope. So I'm wondering if he's saying, kind of like I was saying earlier, like there's some pretty obvious comparisons you could make to Susie and the Banshees with, like, the vocal quality and stuff. But what's, like, making them stand out is just how, like, instrumental her vocals are and how, you know, reverb-drenched, like, Guthrie's guitars are, you know what I mean?
Right.
So that's interesting because, like, that tells me that this group was getting compared to Susie, you know? Because it's right there, dude. Like, her vocals sounded a lot like Susie back then, at least.
Yeah, so actually, I'm reading something here that's pretty interesting, dude, about her vocals. So Robin says here, Liz likes to hear her vocals a certain way through the fold back when we're playing live. So we have everything going through an ADT and a Delta Lab digital delay. Obviously, there are effects on the vocals out front as well, but those vary from gig to gig because different PA companies have different racks of effects, which is why we try to keep the foldback sound consistent. In the studio, I normally record Liz's vocals completely dry, only adding effects at the mixing stage. That way you can go back to the beginning and start again if you want to change something. So she likes the way her vocals sound up on stage. Maybe the way that it sounds back on the, like, the monitors that are facing them and then echoing out into the crowd. So it kind of sounds like he's trying to capture that on record. That's just kind of what I read that, which I think is interesting.
Hmm. Okay. Interesting. Yeah. All right. Well, let's see what else we got here, Q.
All right, Trev. Here we go. Let's jump down to track 6.
I'm ready.
It's another doozy, dude. This one's called In the Gold Dust Rush.
Oh,
Great track, man. No clue what the hell she's saying. But that's, I mean, to me, that's part of the charm of Cocteau Twins, man.
Yeah, it's just, I think so.
Yeah. But here's what I like about that. First of all, the haircuts were something else, man. Something else, dude. You just pulled up like a magazine.
So just for anyone who's interested, their website is actually really cool. I love when bands, especially bands that have been around forever, actually have like clippings.
Yeah, from press coverage and stuff. Yeah.
Every single year.
That's amazing. Yeah.
And you click on a link and a lot of them are just, yeah, look at this, dude. Photocopies.
That's awesome.
Anyways.
First of all, this is a podcaster's dream, Q.
I know, dude. That's why. I know. That's funny because I did all the, like, quote unquote research for this episode.
Yeah, yeah.
Literally half an hour before we started. And I just.
All thanks to their website.
All thanks to their website. But yeah, dude, the hair is. Robin's hair is insanity. Ridiculous. It's even worse than. What's his name? From the Cure. Smith.
Robert
Smith, yeah.
I mean, it looks like those birds, you know, with like the fluffy little puff, you know, tough birds of hair. They're
courting for their mates, doing dances and stuff
like that. Yeah. If you're a bird enthusiast out there, you probably know what I'm talking about. But anyway, like what I like about that track, and I feel like maybe this is part of like the dynamic between Robin and Elizabeth, is like, she's again like being very forward and like almost screaming with the vocals, right? But his guitar sound is so soft and like, you know, kind of more in the background of the song.
Yeah.
So like her vocals, because his instrumentation, like his guitars are so soft, it makes her vocals even more impactful. I feel like it just feels like you're getting sort of like slapped in the face with her vocals, which sounds,
yeah, dude,
like I'm insulting, but that's a compliment. You know what I mean? The way that her vocals are like mixed in the song, they're so like in your face up front. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but also shrouded behind those effects that he adds to it.
Yeah, you take away her vocals, and like what a cool guitar track melody, like guitar tone, like his tone. Yeah, the melody and all that stuff, just great.
And the bass line, like it mentioned in, you know, the description of Ethereal Wave, it's very post-punk oriented bass lines.
But yeah, it's interesting that they're like, oh, we never even thought about making music until we just bumped into each other or whatever. And we weren't influenced by anything. It's like they had to be influenced by somebody.
Right. But yeah, this article from 83, I don't know what publication is, but
Cocktails. That's funny.
Cocktails is the name of the article. Yeah. It says here, I thought this was a good way to put it. It says, they don't seem to have any inkling of the calculation or organization that everybody is telling you that you absolutely must have to produce a record these days. All I can gather is that the music sort of wells out of them from a source untarnished by any of the fakery and tinsel that afflicts the charts in massive doses.
That's why we're still talking about him, right? That's 40 years later.
I think what's interesting about someone saying that in 83 is that this sound felt like it came out of nowhere in 83.
They were defining a new sound.
Untarnished by the fakery and tinsel that afflicts the charts. This doesn't sound like the radio-friendly 80s sound, you know, from the early 80s. So I think that's cool that this was something different.
Yeah, and this was only 83, which, so I mean, they're trailblazers, Q.
Dude, and yeah, get rid of this.
Am I about to be trailblazed?
Yes, Trev. This is the last song for the episode. Last song on the album. My favorite track.
Dude, you gotta love a banger for the last track.
This is beyond a banger, man. Yeah, We're doing two clips.
Q, this is what we talk about, man. You gotta make it to the last track.
I gotta listen to every track,
or you're gonna miss out.
Travis, you're not ready for this, okay?
I'm not. I mean, I'm sitting down. So
All right. Here we go. So this is I don't even know how to say this. Musette and drums.
Did you
you know, we're recording early in the morning, Q, so words aren't coming to the forefront right now. But that's maybe that's the point, dude. Maybe that's the point.
And I was going to say, maybe you're just left speechless because of what you just heard.
You can't describe it, you know?
Right.
Yeah, his guitar playing is kind of, you know, he does a lot of like kind of sliding. Like,
yes, you know, he still does that. I say today, but like, yeah, he still does that with his,
yeah,
and a lot of his solo stuff too.
But that's part of that, like, you know, experimenting with the guitar that like goes on to probably, you know, turn into the glide guitar of Kevin Shields. You know what I mean?
Right.
This is probably like, yeah, dude, sort of like the beginning of that. Just what can I get? What sound can I get out of this guitar? You know what I mean?
Yeah. All right, man. So we're just going to, I'm going to fade it back in and we're just going to play the rest of the song. Best is yet to come. Let's put it this way. This is how you end a record. Okay. Here we go. Just the driving, like, overpoweringness of the way they end that track with that just wailing guitar effects, and man, just gives you gooselies, man. Let me read a little bit farther down in this article, Trevor. This kind of wraps it up real nice, man. The way, like, this music just kind of gets you, especially on this record. It says, their records, and particularly their last LP, Head Over Heels, and the accompanying EP Sunburst and Snowblind, are great washes of swirling sound with the vocals calling darkly through dense fogs of chorused guitar and booming rhythm, garnished with chiming melodies and a sense of drama that leaves me breathless. A sense of drama. I like that.
You know, this is why we leave it to the writers out there to form sentences.
So you got to leave it to the pre-Raphaelites.
Yeah. Did we ever figure out what that was? Did you say what that was supposed to mean?
Yeah.
Pre-Raphaelite.
Yeah. It's, I mean, if you're calling someone a pre-Raphaelite in modern times, let me pull up ChatGPT.
So this is what ChatGPT says. Okay. In modern times.
You would likely be referring to their aesthetic preferences, artistic sensibilities, or perhaps their personality traits, Trav. Pre-Raphaelites, it was like a movement in art.
Okay.
Specifically. Okay. Where, yeah, they were drawn to like Renaissance This is the 1800s, and yeah, it was like a they didn't like the way Raphael and Michelangelo painted landscapes and the, you know, the human figure or whatever, the way that they would pose and stuff.
Got it.
So this was kind of a movement away from that. And also like the way that they, it was kind of like a whole, like a social movement too. These were the hipsters of that time.
Okay. Sort of, sort so of how does that apply to the 80s and Cocteau Twins? Like they're saying that.
So this, that was specifically in describing ethereal wave. The aesthetic of it.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. That's fair enough. Cause like, you look at some of the album art and stuff like that, and maybe like the font choice of
very goth.
Yeah. You can see
and
that.
Like Renaissance goth, not like
black
males painted goth.
I think they even kind of dress like that too.
Right.
A little bit.
Like, dude, everyone on the 4AD label back then.
Got it.
You know, Susie, whoever else was on 480. They were all on 480, I feel like.
Yep.
All right, man. So that's Head Over Heels. That's my picks. Worth it to listen to all the way through, obviously. Sugar Hiccup is another great song. Apparently, there weren't any, like, singles, as in, like, you know, songs that they promoted for the album. So I would say Sugar Hiccup is a song that's more, I guess, radio-friendly.
Okay.
Maybe we can fade out with that one just for fun.
All right.
But yeah, dude, definitely fantastic record all the way through, obviously. Gives it a really good context of, proto shoegaze, post punk proto shoegaze, ethereal wave. This is it, man.
Yeah.
1983. It's already there. And yeah, you can definitely see how Kevin Shields and
definitely
all the
influence
the influence
for sure
is there. Yeah. And I mean, that's all besides her amazing vocals and lyrics, like the sound, that's Robin Guthrie, you know.
Oh yeah,
that's the proto shoegaze sound. I feel like comes a lot from Guthrie and his effect pedals on that guitar and the way he plays it.
Definitely. Well, okay, so far this year, Q, we've covered Dinosaur Jr. Mm-hmm. And we've covered Cocteau Twins. So what do we do next? I'm thinking that we do a nice 180, if you will.
I like 180s.
And we talk about Deftones. I've kind of been teasing that a little bit.
Let's do it.
And that would be an interesting some whiplash here, you know, I think, coming from the heavenly, ethereal Elizabeth Fraser, right? And Robin Guthrie. So, okay. So I think I talked about this last month on the last episode that I was trying to, I was kind of torn between two different albums of Deftones, but I have landed on, you know, one of their most popular records, Around the Fur, came out in 1997. 13 years later from this record, 14 years later, and grunge has already happened, right? So like shoegaze was defined and really came into its own late 80s, right? Grunge happened right around the corner, and then Deftones, which kind of falls in like the new metal camp, you know what I mean, of metal and like alt rock and stuff like that. So should be interesting, Q. And awesome. Finally gonna crank up the volume a little bit in terms of the distortion. So,
well, I think this is one cool thing about doing just one deep dive a month, is because I think we're gonna end up kind of bouncing around a little bit more than what we were doing when we were cranking out an episode every week.
Yeah.
So yeah, that'll be fun, man. But in between this week and in between this episode and that one, we'll have another What You Heard to kind of,
that's right,
to mix it up as well.
Yeah, to cleanse the palate before we go on to Deftones. Because with our What You Heard, it's always, a pretty good mix of genres and decades and stuff. So
for sure.
Cool. So you can find us on Instagram. If you want to reach out to us, just search for No Filler Podcast. Send us your tunes. What have you been listening to lately? What kind of bands are you into? Could be a brand new song, could be a 40-year-old song. If we like a song that you send us, we might play it as the outro to our What You Heard episode for the month. So again, find us on Instagram, No Filler Podcast. You can also find us on the Pantheon Podcast Network if you want to listen to more great music-centered podcasts. It's pantheonpodcast.com. Q, thanks for bringing the tunes.
Anytime, brother.
Got to go back and listen to more of that 80s Cocteau Twins, man. I've been missing that. For sure, man.
Yeah. All right, we're going to fade out with Sugar Hiccup from Head Over Heels. And yeah, that's going to do it for us this week. Thanks, as always, for listening. My name's Quentin.
My name is Travis.
Y'all take care.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more Fantasy Points.